So I'm gonna, yeah, that's my babies. I'm gonna start off with a little humor since we're gonna have a pretty serious conversation. So the hardest thing is pretty funny, but the hardest thing about being up in front of everybody is like everything you do, people see. So like I was literally squirming just now, trying to hold it. I was like, I cannot make it through the whole sermon like this. So let me just run real quick. Actually, so just a little bit more humor. Like, so the churches I grew up in, like people used to run around the church. So like it almost looked like I just caught the spirit, just ran out there. But I just want to say I'm honored to be here today. I just thank you to John and Wayne and Jessica and everybody who put in so much work for this service and planning the service. So just to let y'all know, actually, I got real sick back in May, and I've been sick for like a couple of months now, and I'm finally starting to recover. But I had cut out a lot of things that I had committed to. And it was like, oh, no, I'm going to have to cancel the service. But I was talking to John and Jessica. I told him, I said, this is one thing I don't want to miss because this is a way too important conversation for us to have. So I'm not 100%, the way I was trained, we're trained to spend 25 to 30 hours on a sermon. I wasn't able to spend that much time on it just because of my health. So hopefully this share something today that will be beneficial and to help move the conversation forward. So getting into this, I first want to say RIP to KJ Kwanzabidi, who was killed by Newport News Police Department on July the 4th, 2015. I've been working with Melissa and Clyde since last year on trying to get justice for their son. So along with him, every other hashtag is literally getting to a point where we can't even keep track of who's the next person who's going to die. So RIP to them. And just also, I want to recognize all the political prisoners. They often get forgotten that there are people who have given their lives so that black people can get free, and in their process, they've been incarcerated. So let's recognize them. Are we really free? Are we really free? That's the title of my message today. And the subtitle is White Allies for Black Lives. White Allies for Black Lives. In 2008, the historic election of President Barack Obama, after that we heard the term post-racial. Now that we have our first black president, some kind of way, America no longer has a problem with race. Yep. Black people no longer had to deal with being called the N-word, rejected for loans, subpar education, a lack of jobs, racial profiling, and any of racism whatsoever. It just magically disappeared. Further, some have argued that we should just be colorblind and only recognize each other as humans. This post-racial and colorblind view is pervasive throughout American society. As the local organizer of Black Lives Matter, Williamsburg, and just to clarify that, not just William and Mary, but all of Williamsburg, a graduate student who spends a lot of time researching and just straight up being a black man from the hood, I can tell you that in addition to the lie that we are post-racial, blacks still are not free. Now, some may point to the Emancipation Proclamation, originally written in 1863, ratified on December the 6th, 1865, saying, bam, there goes a point at which slavery ended and blacks obtained their freedom. Well, since the turn of the 20th century, people like Du Bois and Douglass have talked about the debt pianist system, which did not end until 1941. And then if we actually look at, you can actually Google it right now. We'll actually wait till after the service, not during the service. But look at the 13th Amendment. You will find these words: neither slavery or involuntary servitude, except as a punishment for crime, whereof the party shall have been duly convicted, shall exist within United States or any place subject to their jurisdiction. So that means an official American document still states it's very legal for slavery or involuntary servitude to happen here in this country. When you look at our criminal injustice system, you will see the manifestation of this in black lives. Listen to this. We have the world's largest prison population, and U.S. prisoners make up 25%, a quarter of the whole world's prison population. Focusing on black lives, 1 in 3 black men will do time. Black women are more likely to go to prison than any other racial group. This is where we hear the term mass incarceration, and this is why Michelle Alexander says that we're living in a quote-unquote new Jim Crow. Alexander also reveals that the issues blacks are facing is not just being locked up. Rather, and I quote, a larger web of laws, rules, policies, and customs that control those labeled criminals both in and out of prison. The current interconnected system of oppression involves the materiality of bars in prisons and metal detectors in schools, the miseducation from K through college, the brokenness that comes from not being able to get a job or having to work 2 or 3 jobs just to make ends meet, the psychological trauma that comes from the after effects of slavery, always being told to get over life-threatening situations and viewing another black brutalized body at the hands of a police officer that is about to go on paid vacation. After considering all of these factors, there is no way I can claim that blacks today are completely free. We are constantly facing death every day, and any one of us, any other black folk, can be the next hashtag or picture on a shirt. So with that being said, I want to make a moral argument, and I claim that you all, that whites are struggling if blacks are struggling. I believe that because blacks are not completely free in this great democratic nation, then all of its members, everyone who is a part of this nation, are also bound. Martin Luther King Jr. says that, moreover, I am cognizant of the interrelatedness of all communities and states. He says, I cannot sit idly by in Atlanta and not be concerned about what happens in Birmingham. Injustice anywhere is a threat to justice everywhere. We are caught in an, this is a key phrase, inescapable network of mutuality, tied in a single garment of destiny. Whatever affects one directly affects all indirectly. So first, injustice does not have boundaries in a democratic society. The existence of injustice for one group, whether that injustice is small or great, is a part of that society. If we are a nation that claims liberty and justice for all, then we as a nation are not fulfilling that vision. Therefore, America is really a nation of liberty and justice for some, being white people and mainly white men. If white men were the founders of the nation, laid out the visions and the values for this nation, who should then be responsible for the shortcomings of this nation? Further, King says that it is a quote-unquote threat to justice, meaning that injustice will spread. While it's unlikely for the tides to turn and for whites to become oppressed, and by the way, I don't want that to happen. I hope this doesn't happen. The denial of injustice will stop it from spreading to Williamsburg. And I'm saying this because you might see the media reports. You can see what's happening in St. Louis and Baltimore and Florida and say, well, that's not happening here. But because it is happening in the United States, it's still possible, and we're taking what King is saying to be true, it's possible for it to spread here. Moreover, we are all humans. We're all a part of this human race. And while I do not advocate for colorblindness, I do agree with King's notion of a network of mutuality, tying us all together. Whether it is fulfilling your purpose in life or simply asking for directions, at some point, we're all going to need each other. Now, I put all my cards up front, and I recognize that this is a moral argument. We all have various worldviews governing our lives. And if you don't believe in the interdependence of all humanity, that's fine, but still rock with me. So because we have the existence of racism, and I am arguing that we're all connected and that my struggle should be a part of your struggle, I think the reason why that you may reject this notion is because of white privilege. Us black folks, we don't got that privilege. I truly believe that is your white privilege, or i.e. the position that you are in, that allows you to be blind to the racism and the problems that we are facing. On one hand, we can define privilege as the disconnection from the suffering that's going on, i.e. your ability to say, you know what, I don't want to deal with this. I can turn off the news. I can go on with my life. That's privilege. Audrey Smedley, in the book Race in North America, reveals that the relationship that the average had with the English had with the average first began to develop these ideas of ethnocentrism. And then I'm not going to go through the whole thing, but basically, a quick summary of that is the wars that English and Irish had led to the Englishmen thinking that their culture and their way of life is better than the Irish way of life. These same ideals were then brought to America. So when they saw the Englishmen, the planters and the colonizers, saw the Indians, their thoughts about the Irish, oh, hey, we're great. We're building this great nation. We are better than the Indians. So you'll see how these ethnocentric views are building up. And then we move forward to Thomas Jefferson, who's writing to James Madison. He says, we should have such an empire for liberty as none has ever surveyed this creation. Did you all catch that? He said, an empire for liberty. So directly linked to this notion of this, the Englishness, the Englishmen eventually at first being higher than the average, being higher than the average. And then later when we get to the Indians, then we get to the slavery. When we get to slavery, we have this empire where they're higher, they're ruling for liberty. And what's needed in the middle of all that is discrimination and marking another group as inferior. Y'all feel me? Y'all follow me? So then, because this is the setup, the question you may be asking is, Travis, what can I do? I recognize that I have my white privilege on one side, and then we have this whole system of systemic racism on the other side. How can I respond? How can I be a white ally for black lives? So what I did is I actually came up with three words. I'm going to use alliteration because I think alliteration helps us to remember it. And the three terms are sacrifice, serving, and solidarity. All right, so I want y'all to be able to remember this when we leave. So I want y'all to repeat after me, sacrifice, serving, and solidarity. So first, sacrifice. And what I want to do for each one of these, I want to give an explanation of my perspective of this, an example, i.e. a person who lived this out, an application, and then we're going to wrap it up. So sacrifice. To sacrifice is to give up something for something else that you, this is the key point, that you believe is worthy or more important. Inherent within my presentation of sacrifice is loss. Now, I've seen this quote that whites are so privileged that equality feels like oppression. With that quote, what that quote is trying to get at is that giving up something may require some discomfort. Since you are in a higher position, i.e., remember the scale, whites at the top, blacks at the bottom, and have not experienced injustice in the ways that blacks have, it may feel like you are giving up a lot, like you're making this huge sacrifice. But I want to challenge you. I want you to push past any feelings of discomfort. I want you to push past anything that might make you feel like, I don't know, but this, I want to challenge you to push past that. Because if we're really going to get this freedom, if you're going to recognize that my struggle is your struggle, then that means you too might have to struggle a little bit. And while some level of discomfort maybe exists in a way, it's not going to be on the same level as those of us who are oppressed. But I want to challenge you to push past that discomfort. And the example I want to give is a gentleman by the name of Bill Moore. He was born in upstate New York. He moved to Mississippi as a child. By the time he was 35 in 1963, he was a post worker in Baltimore. And what he said was, you know what? I don't like what I saw when I was living in Mississippi. I want to read a quote. He said, equal rights for all in Mississippi or a bus. Which is kind of crazy, right? That he used the word bus in 1960s, like fail a bus, yeah. So he basically said equal rights or bus, as in, even though I'm a white man, I have privilege, I still want my black people to get free. So y'all know what he did? He went on a single person march from Chattanooga, Tennessee to Jackson, Mississippi. On April 23rd, 1963, near a highway in northern Alabama, he was shot twice in the head, close range, with a 22 caliber rifle. He literally gave up his life and sacrifice so that black people could get free. So that's number one, sacrifice. Anybody remember number two? Serving. So when I'm talking about serving, along the lines of sacrifice, this involves, of course, humbling yourself, submitting yourself. But with service, I want to get at actually doing something. If you want to address your privilege and fight white supremacy, I want to challenge you to serve black folk. Serve the oppressed. In M.L. King's sermon, right before he died, he raised this question. He's talking about the Good Samaritan. Real quick, this was a person who was robbed, left on the side of the road. And he said the question those who left them asked, if I stop to help this man, what will happen to me? But what King is pushing us to think about, he says the question shouldn't be that, but the question should be, if I do not stop to help this man, what will happen to him? Y'all following me? What's going to happen to him? What's going to happen to the black folks here in Williamsburg who are struggling and suffering if we as a community don't respond to that? And for a quick example, I actually want to point out your very own Jessica O'Brien. So if you don't know, quick plug, Black Lives Matter is doing we have a lemonade stand. Is where our catchphrase is white people talking to white people about black lives. Jessica has been to every single one we've done so far, but that's a tangible action of service. And I close with this. Anybody remember the last one? Solidarity. Solidarity is positioning yourself where you sympathize with blacks and their trauma and their oppression. And of course, the optimal choice would be to empathize, but I recognize you can't be black. That was supposed to be a joke. But but it's saying, you know what? I want to go ahead and take on. I want to go ahead and take this step. I want to feel, I want to be a part of the struggle. I want to see how it feels. I want to consider how it is to have this psychological trauma, to constantly be dealing with this fear, to always watch your back, to wonder what the police are thinking, to wondering what this lady who's crossing the street think, to take up that position. If you notice inherent with all three of them, from sacrifice to servant to solidarity, it's saying, you know what, I want to intentionally position myself where I'm not going to stay on the top, but I will come down and be equal with all men. And like what King said, this network of mutuality. The one example I give is Ann Davis. I don't know if you all knew her. She was a women marriage student. But she was actively involved. She was involved with everything, actually. I think the one problem, she was almost too involved. But she was literally part of Black Lives Matter, environmental racism, biking for a cure. She gave literally her time, her energy, her effort, everything. And that's what I'm encouraging us to do if we're going to address the problems of systemic racism in Williamsburg. I close with this quote. This is from Frederick Douglass, and he gave this to the school, which is now Case Western. This is the moral battlefield to which their country and their God now called them, in the eye of both. The neutral scholar is an ignoble man. Here, a man must be hot, or be accounted cold, or purchase, something worse than hot or cold. The lukewarm and the cowardly will be rejected by earnest men on either side of the controversy. The cunning man who avoids it to gain the favor of both parties will be rewarded with scorn, and the timid man who shrinks from it for fear of offending either party will be despised. To the lawyer, the preacher, the politician, and to the man of letters, there is no neutral ground. He that is not for us is against us. Grace and peace.